This program is a production of The Edge of Science, pushing the boundaries of human knowledge.
The American Broadcasting Company presents The Search for the Flying Saucers.
Many have seen them, millions have heard about them. It's the biggest who's it, what's it story of the year, the flying saucers. At the moment, we have a fellow up in a plane hunting a flying saucer, and good hunting to him.
It was in 1947. I remember standing in the kitchen and my husband nearby, and over the radio came an announcement, "There are discs flying around my plane." Kenneth Arnold and my husband, at the end of the war, were co-test pilots at Douglas. And that's where he got acquainted with Kenneth Arnold. So he knew he was telling the truth.
UFOs, unidentified flying objects. After World War II, the nation was riveted by reports of mysterious objects that could outpace jet aircraft, making maneuvers at thousands of miles per hour. Officially, it all began on June 24, 1947, when private pilot Kenneth Arnold saw a formation of shiny disks banking along the slopes of Mount Rainier in Washington State.
Newscaster and every newspaper across the nation has made headlines out of it, and this afternoon we are honored indeed to have here in our studio this man, Kenneth Arnold, who we believe may be able to give us a first-hand account and give you the same on what happened. Kenneth, first of all, if you'll move up here to the microphone just a little closer, we'll ask you to just tell in your own fashion, as you told us last night in your hotel room and again this morning, what you were doing there and how this entire thing started.
I was approximately 25 to 28 miles from Mount Rainier. I climbed back up to 9,200 feet, and I noticed to the left of me a chain which looked to me like the tail of a Chinese kite, kind of weaving and going at a terrific speed across the face of Mount Rainier. They seemed to flip and flash in the sun just like a mirror. And in fact, I happened to be at an angle from the sun that seemed to hit the tops of these peculiar-looking things in such a way that it almost blinded you when you looked at them through your plexiglass windshield. They looked something like a pie plate that was cut in half with a sort of a convex triangle in the rear. And the best calculation I could figure out, now even in spite of error, would be around 1,200 miles an hour. And to my knowledge, there isn't anything that I read about outside of some of the German rockets that would go that fast.
Kenneth Arnold's description was the first to capture widespread media attention in the United States. In fact, the term flying saucer was coined by a reporter who interviewed Arnold right after his plane had landed. From then on, the so-called flying discs became a national obsession, as familiar as hula hoops and apple pie.
A large number of perfectly sane and reliable people have been involved in this flying saucer business. Even those of us who have never seen one have become involved.
Well, I saw the thing coming out of the sky. It had one long horn and one big eye.
America suddenly found itself in the midst of a UFO sighting wave. Hundreds of reports began to flood into police stations and military bases. What were the mysterious flying discs? Soviet weapons or invaders from outer space? The public was frightened, curious, and demanding answers. And soon, Hollywood got in on the act, cranking out science fiction movies with flying saucer themes.
Today, from the skies of California, the fields of Kansas, the rice paddies of the Orient, the air lanes of the world, come persistent reports of UFOs, unidentified flying objects which we have come to know as flying saucers.
In the midst of all the media hoopla, a small group of people began to claim that they had been in direct contact with UFO pilots themselves. They claimed that UFOs were indeed interplanetary spacecraft, and that the pilots from other worlds came to Earth with a message of peace. The contactee movement of the 1950s was born. You're listening to The UFO Contact Experience, an exploration of hidden history.
Then my interest turned toward meeting the contactees, people who claimed that they had firsthand personal experience with operators from the flying discs. And in 1956, I met the first contactee, and that was Daniel W. Fry.
Bill Hamilton is a researcher with a lifelong interest in the UFO subject. In the 1950s, he set out to meet those who claimed firsthand contact with flying saucer pilots. Later, he was to become an eyewitness to some of those mysterious contact events.
I found that these men, like Daniel Fry and George Van Tassel, although they did not have college degrees, they were extremely brilliant men. They were self-motivated. They were ambitious. Daniel Fry, on his own, had become a design engineer, had worked on rocket technology, on submarine technology. He was an extremely brilliant man and had a kind of a common wisdom. George Van Tassel was also an extremely brilliant, inventive man, had a very inventive mind.
Those who claimed to be UFO contactees in the 1950s formed popular groups and attracted a significant number of followers. They held public meetings, they published magazines, and they conducted expeditions to locations where they and their followers claimed to have observed UFOs and their occupants on a regular basis. Bill Hamilton knew them all.
Dan Fry had a group that he started called Understanding, and that was in El Monte, California. So I went to some of the meetings because he had guest speakers at these meetings, either investigators, and there weren't too many investigators around 1956, or people who've had personal experiences, and mainly people who had these personal experiences would also come to the meetings. And I met a lot of people at these meetings. I got involved with Daniel Fry's organization, and then I became the vice president of his Unit 1 in El Monte, and also the teenage editor of the small periodical that they put out, also called Understanding Magazine. They wanted me to get teenagers involved in sky watching and looking for UFO activity. Through Daniel Fry, I started to meet other contactees because, of course, they were invited as speakers. And one of them that I met by 1957 was George W. Van Tassel. At that particular time, my aunt had to drive me. I did not drive myself. And she would drive me out to Giant Rock to meet these people, to meet George Van Tassel. And it ended up that in that year, 1957, on my spring vacation from school, when I was in high school, I spent an entire week out at Giant Rock. And what I did in that week was listen to tape recordings about people's experiences. I read books underneath Giant Rock. I met the visitors coming out there, and I had a large amount of time to talk to George Van Tassel himself.
George Van Tassel. George, I wonder if you can tell me about the first contact that you had.
Yes, John. This occurred on August the 24th of 1953 at approximately 2 o'clock in the morning. The wife and I were sleeping out in the open in the desert because of the heat in August. I woke up and looked around, and there was a man standing there at the foot of the bed. I said, "What do you want?" He smiled at me and said, "My name is Solgonda, and I would be pleased to show you our craft."
George Van Tassel's story was that he would hold these sessions and got into communication with another level of intelligence, okay? And he wasn't real certain what this was, all right? Except that they told him that they came from other civilizations in space that were in other densities of existence and that they would overfly the area out there. Well, in 1953, they landed a craft out there on a night of a full moon. And George Van Tassel was out in a sleeping role. It was in August. It was a hot August night, so to speak. His wife was in a sleeping bag next to him. He heard a noise. He looked up, and there was a man standing at the foot of his bedroll. And he thought that maybe it was somebody who was a traveler out on the dirt roads there that did not was not familiar with the desert environment, perhaps had a breakdown in his automobile or had a flat tire or something like that. So he just kind of got up on his elbow, lit a cigarette, and said, "What do you want?" Right? George Van Tassel had a very plain way of speaking to people. "What do you want?" Right? And he said, this man said in reply, "I would be pleased to show you our craft." This is what he said. And he said that this person spoke in perfect diction, like Ronald Coleman type English, right? And with no hesitation. And he said he kind of sat up a little bit more, looked past this man, and saw a glow hovering over the airfield. And he knew then that this wasn't a man that just had a breakdown in his automobile. So he got up, but before he fully got up, he reached out with his left hand and he was trying to pinch his wife, right, awake. And she wouldn't wake up. And maybe this is one of the first instances of this demonstration by an alien entity of having control over someone. He got up. He only had his skivvies on. He took a cigarette. And he did this because when he told me this story the first time, he went through the body language. You know, your body like has a memory of what occurred. So he just repeated this where he flipped the cigarette over toward the rock and saw a shower of sparks as it went out and followed this guy over to the craft. And now he could see that it was this bell-shaped flying saucer, about 36 feet in diameter, about 18 feet high, identical to the ones that George Adamski had photographed.
Perhaps the most famous contactee was George Adamski, who claimed to have been in communication with space travelers who said they came from the planet Venus. He produced close-up photos and 8mm movies supposedly depicting flying saucers darting around in broad daylight.
Amateur astronomer George Adamski saw a saucer land, and he met the pilot of the Venusian.
He started telling me things, and I couldn't understand. And I finally got the idea, I want to know where he's from. I pointed to the sun, and I made one orbit, called it Mercury, named it, and then Venus, and then Earth, and pointed on myself and the Earth. And then I said, "Where you from?" He got the idea. He finally pointed to the sun, and he made one orbit, didn't say nothing. He made a second orbit, and he pointed to himself and to that orbit. Then that meant Venus. That's how I knew he was Venusian.
But the planet Venus, as we know it, can't support life. Its surface temperatures are hot enough to melt lead, and the toxic carbon dioxide atmosphere is denser than water. That didn't seem to deter Adamski and others from making claims that flew in the face of known science, or from marketing their paraphernalia to a public all too eager to believe in the messianic arrival of peaceful space brothers who had come here to rescue humanity. George Adamski also claimed to be a professor of astronomy. He opened up a cafe and a visitor center on the slopes of Mount Palomar, adjacent to one of our largest astronomical observatories. It was later proven that Adamski held no academic degrees and was certainly not a professor. Eventually, investigators discovered that Adamski traveled with an international diplomatic passport, apparently given to him by the Central Intelligence Agency. Obviously, there was much more to the popular contactee phenomenon than met the eye. Perhaps figures like Adamski were encouraged to make the UFO topic sound ridiculous in order to deflect the growing interest of scientists and reporters. In the paranoid Cold War years of the 1950s, what the public did or did not believe was considered crucial for national security. But to those who were directly involved with the contactees themselves, something much more complex and profound was going on. Investigator Bill Hamilton insists that the public has not been told the truth about George Adamski, Daniel Fry, George Van Tassel, and the other early contactees. He insists because he knew these individuals personally and because he was there. You're listening to The UFO Contact Experience, an exploration of hidden history.
These men were not, contrary to some popular belief, charlatans and hoaxers trying to make a fast buck. Van Tassel was lucky if he could keep afloat just selling food and coffee from the cafe or from the restaurant, okay, there, and whatever money people wanted to donate toward carrying on experiments with some of the information that he had been given, technical information. And he wasn't the only contactee given technical information and projects to do. These were, let's say, some of the more popular contactees who had written books or who spoke from the podium. But there were so many more that are unknown today. In fact, I wouldn't even remember some of their names. People just in the crowds that had similar experiences to these men back then. A lot of these bell-shaped craft were around in the 1950s and early 1960s. A lot of people have seen them at close range. Many have even photographed them, and their photographs haven't even seen print. Okay? These were structured objects. These were solid machines. These were real human-type entities coming out of these machines. They weren't hallucinations. They weren't some kind of a psychodrama or whatever other types of explanations people have come up with. According to George Damski, he claimed to have been from the planet Venus. So this is a big point of contention. But understand this. There were six witnesses by the roadside. All signed a notarized statement testifying that they saw George Adamski talking to this man. All right. But it isn't like, and this is real important to understand, as if George Adamski was an isolated case who made up talking to men or women that were coming down in these bell-shaped scout ships. Because in the early 50s, there were many people who had that kind of experience. Many, many people who described seeing these things. So he wasn't the only one. Now, I think it's immaterial as to whether the guy came from Venus or not. My first question is the guy real? Did he really meet somebody there? Was a flying saucer seen? Yes, a flying saucer was seen. A mothership was seen, a large cylindrical mothership. There were jets that came up and circled this mothership. There was a symbol that looked like an elliptical orange seen on the side of the craft. The man made prints in the ground. Plaster of Paris cast were made of those prints. There were symbols on the soles of his shoe. It was very strange, leaving a message behind. George Van Tassel described meeting people pretty similar to this. There were others, a lot of others. Calvin Gerwin, Kelvin Rowe, Orfeo Angelucci, you name it.
Investigator Bill Hamilton has spent decades exploring all facets of the UFO phenomenon. His personal friendships with the early contactees has provided him a unique perspective on a subject often loaded with contradiction and controversy. But perhaps his greatest asset is his own experience. Unlike most investigators in this field, Bill Hamilton is himself an eyewitness.
I saw one of these craft out near Giant Rock. I personally, in the company of George Van Tassel and another contactee, George Hunt Williamson, saw one of these craft coming from the north, all right, and coming in right over the airfield there, and it was pulsating. I did see in 1967 coming flying over Giant Rock two perfect symmetrical discs. Flying side by side, definitely metallic, definitely machines. They had spinning lights right in the center. They flew over a giant rock that I would say no more than 200 feet altitude, and they were still silent. They were going not more than 100 miles an hour, not more than a slow Cessna. And yet they went even, they lowered their altitude even more as they were going toward Goat Mountain. They came down to the end of the runway, and they must have been only about 8 feet off the ground. They executed a right angle turn, another right angle turn, and they came back over our heads. There must have been 150 witnesses to this.
According to Bill Hamilton, these sightings over giant rock in the Mojave Desert of California were not chance occurrences. They were the result of two-way interactions between people on the ground and the alleged operators of the flying discs.
The most bizarre thing of all is their appearance was predicted by somebody who claimed to have been in communication, and the communication he received was, "We are north of you at this latitude, and we have just sent out two reconnaissance craft, which will be over your position in precisely 4 minutes from right now." And I went, baloney. 4 minutes to the second later, the two craft came flying over giant rock, and my jaw dropped.
From the beginning, the UFO contact experience supposedly involved mind-to-mind communication between human contactees and the flying saucer pilots. There were many reports of aerial show and tell, where UFOs maneuvered for observation by human audiences. Bill Hamilton says that he witnessed these types of interactions on a number of occasions.
This was a person among the crowd who I already knew. His name is Robert Short. In Tonopah, Arizona, at another meeting in 1976, Bob Short came up to me in the middle of the day, showed me typewritten this message that he had channeled before. "We will be over your position tonight at Tonopah at 10:30 p.m. if all are in harmony." So he went into trance just before 10:30. There was approximately maybe 50 people at that particular time around him. I'm sitting there with my friend John Maxfield, my wife, my stepdaughter. I got my binoculars and I looked up, and it seemed like there was a massive object, and this blue light was coming out of the front of it like a headlight. No other lights on the object, right? And I'm watching it as it's going through to the north, through the Big Dipper area, and it suddenly shoots off four fireballs, one to the north, one to the south, east and west simultaneously, like a cross, right? And I followed the one that I see fired to the north. So I'm moving my binoculars like this, and as I'm scanning and following it, I see another object with the blue headlight coming toward this other one that was coming from the south. And I'm going, what's going on here? So I stopped on that one, and I watched the two of them come closer and closer and closer until it looked like they were going to come into kissing contact with one another, right? And they stopped and reversed their motion, right? And then stopped again. And I could faintly see that from one of the objects was coming a blue beam of light. And I traced it all the way down to the ground, right into Bob Short. And that's what they were using for communication. And I could see it for the first time. It was incredible. And then it just kind of faded out as the trance was over and the lights disappeared. In relating this event that happened at Tonopah to an engineer, he was telling me, oh, it was probably hoaxed by the guy. He put up a balloon with a flare or something. And I told him, I said, no way is that possible. I said, these objects were very high up. And I had Bob Short under observance for most of the day. And I said, no way. But you see, this, there's the resistance and the reluctance, just because it sounds bizarre to the rational mind. And yet this happened. I have witnesses, see? It's rejected out of hand. And this is happening all of the time.
Bill Hamilton began his exploration of the UFO phenomenon at a very early age. As a teenager, he and a friend pursued the most recent books on the subject and engaged in regular Skywatch activities. As his research deepened, so did his personal involvement with the phenomenon itself. Perhaps the most significant reason for his continued interest in the subject were his own contact experiences.
I did have some sort of telepathic communication going with the operators of the discs for a period of 3 years between 1957 and 1960, because they would respond to me, they would appear over my house, they would hover, they would maneuver as requested mentally, and there was some kind of telepathic communication going on when their craft were in observation. This is something that my buddy and Ives were doing, like, frequently, and I was coming home, and I would tell my aunt, "Aunt Lee, we went out again tonight, we'd sit on the lawn, and we started, you know, we didn't know what we were talking about at that particular time, but we had the idea that we were beaming our thoughts out into space, and that suddenly these flying saucers would show up, and they would start maneuvering, and it was like we were using the movement of the saucers as if they were a Ouija board or something. In other words, we have a question in our minds. Now, if the answer to the question is yes, do a right angle turn to the right. If it's no, do a right angle turn to the left," something like that, right? And so this way, we would see the response to our questions, and we wouldn't have to totally depend on whether we were getting a correct telepathic impression, right? So I was telling my aunt this, and I thought, boy, she's accepting all of this, and she's accepting of my experiences. And then I came to find out she was just humoring me. So one night, it was like they gave me a telepathic signal. "We're coming over." I went out. There it was. The glowing red disc. Bigger than a star. I believe it was remote controlled. Don't ask me why. I think it was small. No more than 6 feet in diameter, flying fairly low, silently. Then I called my aunt out, and I said, "Watch this now. I will repeat it out loud. Okay, turn left, turn right, turn around." And each time I said a command like that, it would obey my command. And she would go, "Oh, my God, you're talking to it." And then I knew that was the first time she really believed it. Okay, so that's an example. And it was very convincing to me that if something is responding to my talking or even to my thinking that way, then I was dealing with something that was not of this earth, that was a very unusual phenomena. So it isn't just seeing an unknown aerial object, it's this feeling and this mental interaction that was going on at the same time.
You're listening to the UFO Contact Experience, an exploration of hidden history. In the second part of this program, we move forward in time. Present-day contactees and eyewitnesses describe events that continue to occur around the world. This program is a production of The Edge of Science, pushing the boundaries of human knowledge. I'm Ralph Steiner.
At that moment, I opened my eyes and looked to the left, at which point I saw a spaceship on the horizon, as did most of the group. And it had a disc-like shape with a dome on top.
When I saw that sphere, that orb, that spaceship, so close to me, and I knew with my own eyes, as I stared at it and knew that it wasn't part of the background, it wasn't a trick of my eyes, it wasn't someone trying to hypnotize me or convince me or anything, I saw it for half an hour. Nobody can take that away from me.
It was really time that we try to come together as a global society to establish some kind of contact or communication with these objects. To me, the question isn't, are they real, or even what are they? The question is, what are we going to do about it?
The observations described in this program are not unique to location or time. They continue to occur, decade after decade, all over the world. Such was the case in 1974, when a group of students at the Catholic University of Lima, Peru, began to experiment with meditation and mental telepathy. Sixto Paz is a Peruvian contactee whose remarkable experiences began as a lark with his friends. He went on to found Grupo Rama, one of the largest contactee networks on Earth. In the 4 decades since its founding, Rama boasts of training perhaps thousands of people in Latin America from all walks of life to communicate with non-human intelligence. Speaking through an interpreter, Sixto Paz describes his very first contact event.
La experiencia nuestra empezó en 1974 en el Perú.
This experience began back in 1974 in Peru. We were a group of friends studying the Catholic University in Lima, and we were practicing yoga when an institution that investigates the UFO phenomenon organized a conference about ESP and the possibility that beings from other worlds would not only be flying close to Earth, but also trying to communicate in a different level with us. We were speaking about telepathy. And so when the conference was over, we tried in my house to put in practice what we had heard about this telepathy. There had been some time of practice already of concentration and meditation. We thought that even though we hadn't developed telepathy because of ignorance, well, maybe they would have already developed this ability, and they would be trying to communicate with us. And if we couldn't be the transmitters, maybe we could be the receivers. And like playing, we tried, and in the night, in the evening of January 1974. And it happened, something that we really didn't think of that would happen. We received a message. Naturally, we didn't believe it was true, even though it came after a strong meditation and concentration period. We thought that it was a suggestion, an illusion. So on the following day, we tried it again with a group of 20 friends. And once again, this supposedly extraterrestrial being came and gave us a message. These messages came through psychography or automatic writing. We were totally conscious, we were not in trance, and the message said, "This living room is good for the communication. We can have contact with you. We come from Morling. You call it Ganymede, one of Jupiter's moons. My name is Oxalk, and soon you will see us." Then we asked him where could we see him, where we could contemplate the traveling, the passing of the spaceship. Then we received an appointment to go to a place 60 kilometers south of Lima. And since we wouldn't lose anything by trying, almost in a jokeful way, we just went. We didn't take this very seriously, but it happened, something that we didn't imagine it would really happen. 9 p.m. behind a hill, one of the persons in the group shouted that he was seeing a light. This light traveled quickly towards the right side, and there it stopped. It was close enough to see its shape like a burger sandwich. And then this object came close and began to descend. The object stayed on top of us like at about 80 meters. So it was a big roof of light above us. That the entire sky was covered by this light, and we were like at daylight. At that time, all of us heard something like words that were being spoken to our minds simultaneously. We don't come down at this moment because you cannot control your emotions. And it was true. Some of us were shouting and telling him to go away. If at that time the object descended, landed, he would find us all lying on the ground, fainted. It was an indefinite time above us, since we, because of the fear, we couldn't measure the time precisely. After that, the object began to move and at a quick rate went towards the sea. The place chosen for this was a place in the desert, not near populated area. And it's going in the same direction, that's south, towards Nazca, the Nazca Line area. When the object went away, we all jumped in the air and we were very happy and we embraced each other. And then a total silence overcame us because we didn't know what we had accomplished. From happiness, we passed into confusion. And we said, why us? During the first month, the only person that received the messages was me. Thereafter, we were 8 persons receiving these communications. To the same questions came the same answers. They said, it's not us that communicate with them, but it's rather them that communicate with us. And just like with us, this was happening with many other persons around the world, and also with people at the government level. And they say that this is not the only extraterrestrial civilization that communicates with us, but that there are many others. And that there are many levels in the cosmos, levels of life. Some are higher, some are just like us, and some are lower. Just like different situations happen just inside our own planet. During the first months, they were trying us, testing us, submitting us to self-control tests. They used to invite us to go out to the desert once or twice a month, then the ships would come, and they would send like flashes of light. Like, there's the concept of like a cannon, you know, like. And then they would invite us to go and sit where the phosphorescence, a sort of bluish phosphorescence, was glowing there on the ground. And there we would do the same practices of from yoga, concentration, meditation. And then when we returned home, we used to have this sort of sunburn, as if we had been exposed to daylight. Then they would tell us that each one of us should go by himself or herself and meditate alone in the desert, and to learn to overcome the fears, even the fears from ourselves, if we truly wanted to see them as they really were.
Peruvian contactee Sixto Paz, founder of Grupo Rama, perhaps the largest network of UFO contactees on Earth. Thus began a multi-decade cultivation of outreach and communication that continues to this day. Grupo Rama has pioneered efforts to train people from all walks of life to establish meaningful contact with non-human intelligences. Much of their work is accomplished quietly, without fanfare or publicity, in an effort to avoid interference from governments and the military. Central to the success of Rama's efforts has been its reliance upon mental disciplines, such as those embodied by meditation and yoga. States of deep relaxation and focus seem to be key to unlocking our own latent telepathic abilities and reducing our natural fear response to the unknown. And mental telepathy appears to be the preferred channel of communication between visiting non-terrestrials and humans. This theme of meditation being used to enhance telepathy and calm the emotions is echoed by contactees around the world.
I've been here about 25 years, and we started building the ranch here as a healing retreat center. I would say about 10 years into this place, putting this place together, I started seeing the UFOs on a regular basis, and then they started speaking to me telepathically in the meditations I was doing.
James Gilliland is a North American spiritual practitioner, healer, and contactee. During the late 80s and 90s, he began to experience frequent encounters with UFOs hovering over his homestead at the base of Mount Adams in Washington State. Since then, he has built a sanctuary where he trains people to engage non-human intelligence using the practice of meditation to facilitate contact. He's amassed an enormous body of video and photographic evidence of those contact events.
We get a lot of photographs. We have everything from actually physical craft, you can see antennas on them and things like that, to light ships, to ships that look just like giant aircraft carriers. They're just massive. Those were with multiple investigators here, and we have ships landing on the mountain, morphing from one to three back to one again, showing really clearly that they're way beyond anything that we have. And I've shown these to top people in NASA. We've had Air Force Base commanders here. We've had triple PhD Boeing engineers come here. We've had Skunk Works, Lockheed engineers have come and seen the ships, and they even testified on Coast to Coast that this is real, the ships are here, and it's an ongoing experience.
In addition to a wide range of frequently observable UFOs around his property, James Gilliland and his associates report face-to-face encounters with entities that are clearly not human, and some of these have been photographed.
We've had some that have a head almost like the movie E.T. They look just like the ones in the movie E.T. They're taller, and they wore robes. And we've had a lot of different kinds, some very thin ones, very tall, thin ones. The main ones we work with are Pleiadians that are much like us. A good example is we've had feline beings appear to us here. And they're humanoid felines, and there's fifth, sixth, and seventh dimensional ones. There's different types. And, you know, I thought I was losing it, and I just said, this is crazy, but we're actually photographing them and having, you know, master teachers come here that are Taoist monks and things like that that are photographing these beings appearing to them. A lot of the contacts we've been having here are benevolent. They're very very enlightening, you might say. They help with all kinds of issues. They help with understanding, you know, what's happening here on the Earth. They're focused on the awakening and healing of Earth. They're assisting us to release the past. And most of them are coming from a very extreme consciousness or a high-level consciousness.
As in the case of other contactees, James Gilliland attributes all of this paranormal activity to his cultivation of certain states of consciousness and his decades-long practice of meditation. It also appears that people who visit his ranch and sanctuary experience these phenomena in proportion to their own states of awareness and growth.
Well, it's very important to have a clear mind. And, you know, I always say the prerequisites for a contact is have an open mind, a loving heart, and pure intent. And then you're going to connect with beings, you know, on the same level. There's an old sign, the mind in which you seek is the mind in which you connect. An old saying, I mean. But it's very important to heal any old wounds and traumas and wrong conclusions from past experience, transcend your fears, and, you know, get past the separation game we're playing down here. And, you know, shift into the unity consciousness, and then you're at the same level they are, so you can work with them.
You're listening to The UFO Contact Experience, an exploration of hidden history.
The CE5 initiative is really an attempt to build a bridge between Earth's civilization and these other civilizations. And I think there are at least four or five of them, by the way, that are out there observing us. And so we're trying to figure out, how can you create the environment? How can you set the stage for that to happen? And it's a very complex issue, and it's something which involves a great many, many issues, not the least of which is the question of what our motives are.
Emergency room physician Dr. Stephen Greer had a number of UFO encounters as a child and young adult. Before becoming a doctor, he spent years practicing and teaching transcendental meditation in the United States and abroad. In 1990, he founded the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, CSETI, an organization dedicated to establishing contact through systematic and repeatable practices. Dr. Greer is also founder of the Disclosure Project, the first organization to have succeeded in bringing forward the testimony of military, corporate, and governmental witnesses to UFO events.
Now, you can't go to the Harvard Library and read about how to establish diplomatic liaison with extraterrestrial life forms. And so this is something we've had to pretty much make it up as we go along. And from that has arisen the CSETI project. The chief research component is the what we call the CE5 initiative, which is the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind initiative.
The term Close Encounters was popularized by director Steven Spielberg in his 1977 science fiction film, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But this terminology was actually introduced decades before by Northwestern University astronomer and Air Force consultant Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who invented it as a classification system for UFO sightings. Dr. Greer has taken this classification system a step further.
You'll notice that a close encounter of the first, second, third, and fourth kind, first being a sighting within 500 feet of a UFO, a close encounter of the second kind being some sort of landing trace or physical evidence, a third kind seeing a humanoid associated or sometimes not associated with one of these craft, and a fourth kind being taken on board. That these are all fairly passive. In fact, they are all very passive categories. What close encounters of the fifth kind are is humans empowering themselves to say, all right, if these things are out there and we're here, let's try to bridge that gap. Let's try to do something proactive for a change and actually go out to where these objects are being reported on some sort of consistent basis and attempt using lights, lasers, tones, and other modalities to establish some sort of a communication link. And that is what the CE5, or Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind initiative, is all about.
I'd been reading Dr. Greer's book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. I was very engaged in it. I was doing some meditations. I signed up for his ambassador training in Joshua Tree, which was in November, the first week of November 2008. And I went to the Joshua Tree event, which was five quite incredible days.
Never having had a UFO experience before, newcomer Nancy Snedden attended a CSETI training workshop with Dr. Stephen Greer. She was surprised by what she observed.
We were sitting out in Joshua Tree. Dr. Greer was talking. I had been sitting with my eyes closed, sort of listening to him. And for some unknown reason, at that moment, I opened my eyes and looked to the left, at which point I saw a spaceship on the horizon, as did most of the group. And it had a disc-like shape with a dome on top and a kind of angular shape that came up out of the join between the dome and the saucer part. Meanwhile, we set up the radar and the recording devices and so forth. And at that point, things really started happening in the sky. It was like I counted at least 26 falling stars, just myself looking in one direction, and other people were seeing them too. There were lots of sightings. He was pointing his laser beam at Sirius and in the direction of Orion and talking to us about the Orion transmissions. And he was putting his light around Sirius when all of a sudden, very close to us, it seemed like maybe 50 yards at the most, a bright golden ball just peered out of nowhere and went shooting across the sky, parallel to the ground, and stopped right where his laser beam was, and then disappeared. On the way out of the sight, all of a sudden, the whole sky just lit up in this great flash.
In 2010, in October, it occurred to me that the CE5, the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind protocols that Dr. Greer created for doing rather easy and consciousness-based contact with ET intelligence. He had spent many years through his projects promoting these protocols, teaching people through his trainings, through his books, through his lectures, by whatever means, to do it for themselves.
Costa Macreas is a software engineer in Silicon Valley who had some unusual experiences while attending a CSETI training workshop. He decided to form a global network of contactees, all working together simultaneously. Today, he coordinates up to 70 groups of practitioners worldwide, and they continue to get positive results.
I decided that the Global CE5 ET Contact Initiative could be born then, and gathered some people to start doing a coordinated one-time-a-month event every month, where during a 24-hour period, no matter where we were in the world, we would virtually join with each other as representatives of humanity and do our coordinated contact with ET intelligence. Though I founded and facilitate the Global CE5 ET Contact Initiative, really its center is everywhere. Every single person in that network is an influencer, and that's what makes this powerful. It's decentralized, and it's full of enthusiasm, because believe me, most people do get encounters of many different kinds. I've been hearing about it over and over with hundreds of stories, and that kind of genuine enthusiasm that's engendered is what makes you a convincing advocate for this work when you're the person who wants to have a cousin or a coworker or a spouse join you. It's all very genuine and heartfelt and real. So that's how we're growing right now.
It was in 1947, Kenneth Arnold himself talking. I don't know why, but for some reason they thought it was so unusual, they connected it straight to the radio. And that's the first time and only time, I think, that it was ever on a radio where there was any acknowledgement of something like that happening. You know, after that, they immediately would call them balloons or anything.
And the retrospect on this is, oh, today we're looking at abductions by little gray aliens, and on a lot less evidence, some of these stories are accepted than the evidence contactees presented concerning their own experiences.
It wasn't until 1960 that I actually got in touch with groups. Sure enough, there was Understanding Group number 23, which my husband and I joined at the time, and we listened to all the lectures the next 7 years. Dan Fry's organization, yes, and we got acquainted with him.
The one guy who has demonstrated down-to-earth stability, good logical reasoning, with an engineering background to back it up, has been Dan Fry. I want to give you one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet, Dan Fry.
I'm going to read to you a portion of the recorded history of the UFO appearances during the last few centuries. It is not by any means the complete history of that time, but will give you some idea of the worldwide nature of the phenomena and its constantly repetitive nature.
They were self-motivated, they were ambitious. Daniel Fry, on his own, had become a design engineer, had worked on a rocket technology, on submarine technology. He was an extremely brilliant man and had a kind of a common wisdom.
The UFO phenomena has been around for a lot longer than 200 years. In fact, the Vimanas were discussed, the flying saucers were discussed in India, B.C., for the birth of Christ, and in fact, in every language in which history has ever been written, and in every age and era in which history has ever been written.
And my primary underlying interest in all of this over the years is a fascination with new knowledge, with the science and the technology that we could learn on all levels, not just physical sciences, but and biological sciences, but social sciences, mental sciences, and spiritual sciences, if you want to consider that in the scientific arena.
Now open the era of the contactees.
That is, people who claimed that saucers had landed and that they had made contact with the actual occupants. Among the first important of these contactees was Dan Fry. His initial experience took place on the 4th of July back in the year of 1950 at the White Sands Proving Grounds in New Mexico.
I know the time frame was about the middle 60s when all of that kind of slowed down, and I can suggest to you, from what I've heard, a possible answer, and that is this, that these people who met the contactees claimed that they also had met with our leaders and had made them certain offers, but the offers were not offers of technology. It was only offers of help on straightening out certain problems that we have on our planet. And that these offers were rejected because they did not offer to share their technology with us. And we were primarily interested from a military standpoint in their technology. They didn't want us to go on a shooting spree throughout the universe using this kind of technology. They felt that we were already had overproduced in the weapons department, okay, and that we were already bringing on ecological damage in the early 50s, and they were very concerned about this. But they primarily told us that we had advanced our material sciences at too great a rate beyond what we have developed in our social and spiritual sciences, and that there needed to be a balance.
And I says, do you believe in UFOs? And she says, yes, that's what I'm out here for. So anyway, the rest of the time we talked about UFOs, that there were organizations and things like that. And I said, how do you get in touch with them? She said, when you get to San Jose, get in touch with the Metaphysical Library and ask them if there are any groups there. And she says, but I don't talk about it because they think you're loony.
You've been listening to Part 1 of the UFO Contact Experience, an exploration of hidden history. This program was written and produced by Ralph Steiner, with gratitude and thanks to the following: William Hamilton III, Hildegard Graves, Michael Lindemann, Leslie Kane, Whitley Strieber, the George Adamski Foundation, the Center for UFO Studies, the American Broadcasting Company, Long John Nebel, and the National Archives of the United States. Music provided by Benny Goodman and his orchestra, courtesy of Verve Records. Audio of Sixto Paz appears courtesy of Daniel Drayson. Copies of this and related programs are available online for download at theedgeofscience.com. That's one word, no spaces, theedgeofscience.com. This program is a production of The Edge of Science, pushing the boundaries of human knowledge.